could. Rather, when Ariely gave them anything like the invisibility of the Ring of Gyges, they cheated only up to the point where they themselves could no longer find a justification that would preserve their belief in their own honesty. The bottom line is that in lab experiments that give people invisibility combined with plausible deniability, most people cheat. The press secretary, also known as the inner lawyer, is so good at finding justifications that most of these cheaters leave the experiment as convinced of their own virtue as they were when they walked in. 4. Reasoning and Google can take you wherever you want to go. When my son Max was 3 years old, I discovered that he's allergic to must. When I would tell him that he must get dressed so that we can go to school, and he loved to go to school, he'd scowl and whine. The word must is a little verbal handcuff that triggered in him the desire to squirm free. The word can is so much nicer. Can you get dressed so that we can go to school? To be certain that these two words were really night and day, I tried a little experiment. After dinner one night, I said, "Max, you must eat ice cream now." "But I don't want to." 4 seconds later, "Max, you can have ice cream if you want." "I want some." The difference between can and must is the key to understanding the profound effects of self-interest on reasoning. It's also the key to understanding many of the strangest beliefs in UFO abductions, quack medical treatments, and conspiracy theories. The social psychologist Tom Gilovich studies the cognitive mechanisms of strange beliefs. His simple formulation is that when we want to believe something, we ask ourselves, "Can I believe it?" Then, as Kuhn and Perkins found, we search for supporting evidence, and if we find even a single piece of pseudo-evidence, we can stop thinking. We now have permission to believe. We have a justification in case anyone asks. In contrast, when we don't want to believe something, we ask ourselves, "Must I believe it?" Then we search for contrary evidence, and if we find a single reason to doubt the claim, we can dismiss it. You only need one key to unlock the handcuffs of must. Psychologists now have file cabinets full of findings on motivated reasoning, showing the many tricks people use to reach the conclusions they want to reach. When subjects are told that an intelligence test gave them a low score, they choose to read articles criticizing, rather than supporting, the validity of IQ tests. When people read a fictitious scientific study that reports a link between caffeine consumption and breast cancer, women who are heavy coffee drinkers find more flaws in the study than do men and less caffeinated women. Pete Ditto at the University of California at Irvine asked subjects to lick a strip of paper to determine whether they have a serious enzyme deficiency. He found that people wait longer for the paper to change color, which it never does, when a color change is desirable, than when it indicates a deficiency. And those who get the undesirable prognosis find more reasons why the test might not be accurate. For example, "My mouth was unusually dry today." The difference between a mind asking, "Must I believe it?" versus "Can I believe it?" is so profound that it even influences visual perception. Subjects who thought they'd get something good if a computer flashed up a letter rather than a number were more likely to see an ambiguous figure as a capital B rather than as the number 13. If people can literally see what they want to see, given a bit of ambiguity, is it any wonder that scientific studies often fail to persuade the general public? Scientists are really good at finding flaws in studies that contradict their own views, but it sometimes happens that evidence accumulates across many studies to the point where scientists must change their minds. I've seen this happen in my colleagues and myself many times, and it's part of the accountability system of science. You'd look foolish clinging to discredited theories. But for non-scientists, there is no such thing as a study you must believe. It's always possible to question the methods, find an alternative interpretation of the data, or, if all else fails, question the honesty or ideology of the researchers. And now that we all have access to search engines on our cell phones, we can call up a team of supportive scientists for almost any conclusion 24 hours a day. Whatever you want to believe about the causes of global warming or whether a fetus can feel pain, just Google your belief. You'll find partisan websites summarizing and sometimes distorting relevant scientific studies. Science is a smorgasbord, and Google will guide you to the study that's right for you. 5. We can believe almost anything that supports our team. Many political scientists used to assume that people vote selfishly, choosing the candidate or policy that will benefit them the most. But decades of research on public opinion have led to the conclusion that self-interest is a weak predictor of policy preferences. Parents of children in public school are not more supportive of government aid to schools than other citizens. Young men subject to the draft are not more opposed to military escalation than men too old to be drafted. And people who lack health insurance are not more likely to support government-issued health insurance than people covered by insurance. Rather, people care about their groups, whether those be racial, regional, religious, or political. The political scientist Don Kinder summarizes the findings like this, quote, "In matters of public opinion, citizens seem to be asking themselves not what's in it for me, but rather what's in it for my group," end quote. Political opinions function as badges of social membership. They're like the array of bumper stickers people put on their cars showing the political causes, universities, and sports teams they support. Our politics is groupish, not selfish. If people can see what they want to see in the ambiguous figure B or 13, just imagine how much room there is for partisans to see different facts in the social world. Several studies have documented the attitude polarization effect that happens when you give a single body of information to people with differing partisan leanings. Liberals and conservatives actually move further apart when they read about research on whether the death penalty deters crime, or when they rate the quality of arguments made by candidates in a presidential debate, or when they evaluate arguments about affirmative action or gun control. In 2004, in the heat of the U.S. presidential election, Drew Westen used fMRI to catch partisan brains in action. He recruited 15 highly partisan Democrats and 15 highly partisan Republicans and brought them into the scanner one at a time to watch 18 sets of slides. The first slide in each set showed either a statement from President George W. Bush or one from his Democratic challenger, John Kerry. For example, people saw a quote from Bush in 2000 praising Ken Lay, the CEO of Enron, which later collapsed when its massive frauds came to light. Quote, "I love the man. When I'm president, I plan to run the government like a CEO runs a country. Ken Lay and Enron are a model of how I'll do that." Then they saw a slide describing an action taken later that seemed to contradict the earlier statement. Mr. Bush now avoids any mention of Ken Lay and is critical of Enron when asked. At this point, Republicans were squirming. But right then, Westen showed them another slide that gave more context, resolving the contradiction. People who know the president report that he feels betrayed by Ken Lay and was genuinely shocked to find that Enron's leadership had been corrupt. There was an equivalent set of slides showing Kerry caught in a contradiction and then released. In other words, Westen engineered situations in which partisans would temporarily feel threatened by their candidate's apparent hypocrisy. At the same time, they'd feel no threat and perhaps even pleasure when it was the other party's guy who seemed to have been caught. Westen was actually pitting two models of the mind against each other. Would subjects reveal Jefferson's dual process model, in which the head, the reasoning parts of the brain, processes information about contradictions equally for all targets, but then gets overruled by a stronger response from the heart, the emotion areas? Or does the partisan brain work as Hume says, with emotional and intuitive processes running the show and only putting in a call to reasoning when its services are needed to justify a desired conclusion? The data came out strongly supporting Hume. The threatening information, their own candidate's hypocrisy, immediately activated a network of emotion-related brain areas, areas associated with negative emotion and responses to punishment. The handcuffs of "must I believe it" hurt. Some of these areas are known to play a role in reasoning, but there was no increase in activity in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. The DLPFC is the main area for cool reasoning tasks. Whatever thinking partisans were doing, it was not the kind of objective weighing or calculating that the DLPFC is known for. Once Westen released them from the threat, the ventral striatum started humming. That's one of the brain's major reward centers. All animal brains are designed to create flashes of pleasure when the animal does something important for its survival, and small pulses of the neurotransmitter dopamine in the ventral striatum and a few other places are where these good feelings are manufactured. Heroin and cocaine are addictive because they artificially trigger this dopamine response. Rats who can press a button to deliver electrical stimulation to their reward centers will continue pressing until they collapse from starvation. Weston found that partisans escaping from handcuffs by thinking about the final slide, which restored their confidence in their candidate, got a little hit of dopamine. And if this is true, then it would explain why extreme partisans are so stubborn, closed-minded, and committed to beliefs that often seem bizarre or paranoid. Like rats that cannot stop pressing a button, partisans may be simply unable to stop believing weird things. The partisan brain has been reinforced so many times for performing mental contortions that free it from unwanted beliefs. Extreme partisanship may be literally addictive. The rationalist delusion. Webster's Third New International Dictionary defines delusion as a false conception and persistent belief, unconquerable by reason, in something that has no existence in fact. As an intuitionist, I'd say that the worship of reason is itself an illustration of one of the most long-lived delusions in Western history, the rationalist delusion. It's the idea that reasoning is our most noble attribute, one that makes us like the gods, for Plato, or that brings us beyond the delusion of believing in gods, for the new atheists. The rationalist delusion is not just a claim about human nature. It's also a claim that the rational caste, philosophers or scientists, should have more power, and it usually comes along with a utopian program for raising more rational children. From Plato through Kant and Kohlberg, many rationalists have asserted that the ability to reason well about ethical issues causes good behavior. They believe that reasoning is the royal road to moral truth, and they believe that people who reason well are more likely to act morally. But if that were the case, then moral philosophers, who reason about ethical principles all day long, should be more virtuous than other people. Are they? The philosopher Eric Schwitzgebel tried to find out. He used surveys and more surreptitious methods to measure how often moral philosophers give to charity, vote, call their mothers, donate blood, donate organs, clean up after themselves at philosophy conferences, and respond to emails purportedly from students. And in none of these ways are moral philosophers better than other philosophers or professors in other fields. Schwitzgebel even scrounged up the missing book lists from dozens of libraries and found that academic books on ethics, which are presumably borrowed mostly by ethicists, are more likely to be stolen or just never returned than books in other areas of philosophy. In other words, expertise in moral reasoning does not seem to improve moral behavior, and it might even make it worse, perhaps by making the writer more skilled at post hoc justification. Schwitzgebel has yet to find a single measure on which moral philosophers behave better than other philosophers. Anyone who values truth should stop worshiping reason. We all need to take a cold, hard look at the evidence and see reasoning for what it is. The French cognitive scientists Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber recently reviewed the vast research literature on motivated reasoning in social psychology and on the biases and errors of reasoning in cognitive psychology. They concluded that most of the bizarre and depressing research findings make perfect sense once you see reasoning as having evolved not to help us find truth, but to help us engage in arguments, persuasion, and manipulation in the context of discussions with other people. As they put it, quote, "skilled arguers are not after the truth, but after arguments supporting their views," end quote. This explains why the confirmation bias is so powerful and so ineradicable. How hard could it be to teach students to look on the other side, to look for evidence against their favored view? Yet, in fact, it's very hard, and nobody has yet found a way to do it. It's hard because the confirmation bias is a built-in feature of an argumentative mind, not a bug that can be removed from a Platonic mind. I'm not saying we should all stop reasoning and go with our gut feelings. Gut feelings are sometimes better guides than reasoning for making consumer choices and interpersonal judgments. But they are often disastrous as a basis for public policy, science, and law. Rather, what I'm saying is that we must be wary of any individual's ability to reason. We should see each individual as being limited, like a neuron. A neuron is really good at one thing, summing up the stimulation coming into its dendrites to decide whether to fire a pulse along its axon. A neuron by itself isn't very smart. But if you put neurons together in the right way, you get a brain. You get an emergent system that is much smarter and more flexible than a single neuron. In the same way, each individual reasoner is really good at one thing, finding evidence to support the position he or she already holds, usually for intuitive reasons. We should not expect individuals to produce good, open-minded, truth-seeking reasoning, particularly when self-interest or reputational concerns are in play. But if you put individuals together in the right way, such that some individuals can use their reasoning powers to disconfirm the claims of others, and all individuals feel some common bond or shared fate that allows them to interact civilly, you can create a group that ends up producing good reasoning as an emergent property of the social system. This is why it's so important to have intellectual and ideological diversity within any group or institution whose goal is to find truth, such as an intelligence agency or a community of scientists, or to produce good public policy, such as a legislature or advisory board. And if our goal is to produce good behavior, not just good thinking, then it's even more important to reject rationalism and embrace intuitionism. Nobody is ever going to invent an ethics class that makes people behave ethically after they step out of the classroom. Classes are for riders, and riders are just going to use their new knowledge to serve their elephants more effectively. If you want to make people behave more ethically, there are two ways you can go. You can change the elephant, which takes a long time and is hard to do, or, to borrow an idea from the book Switch by Chip Heath and Dan Heath, you can change the path that the elephant and rider find themselves traveling on. You can make minor and inexpensive tweaks to the environment, which can produce big increases in ethical behavior. You can hire Glaucon as a consultant and ask him how to design institutions in which real human beings, always concerned about their reputations, will behave more ethically. In sum, the first principle of moral psychology is intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. To demonstrate the strategic functions of moral reasoning, I reviewed 5 areas of research showing that moral thinking is more like a politician searching for votes than a scientist searching for truth. 1. We are obsessively concerned about what others think of us, although much of that concern is unconscious and invisible to us. 2. Conscious reasoning functions like a press secretary who automatically justifies any position taken by the president. 3. With the help of our press secretary, we are able to lie and cheat often and then cover it up so effectively that we convince even ourselves. 4. Reasoning can take us to almost any conclusion we want to reach because we ask, "Can I believe it?" when we want to believe something, but "Must I believe it?" when we don't want to believe. The answer is almost always yes to the first question and no to the second. 5. In moral and political matters, we are often groupish rather than selfish. We deploy our reasoning skills to support our team and to demonstrate commitment to our team. I concluded by warning that the worship of reason, which is sometimes found in philosophical and scientific circles, is a delusion. It is an example of faith in something that does not exist. I urged instead a more intuitionist approach to morality and moral education, one that is more humble about the abilities of individuals and more attuned to the contexts and social systems that enable people to think and act well. I have tried to make a reasoned case that our moral capacities are best described from an intuitionist perspective. I do not claim to have examined the question from all sides, nor to have offered irrefutable proof. Because of the insurmountable power of the confirmation bias, counterarguments will have to be produced by those who disagree with me. Eventually, if the scientific community works as it is supposed to, the truth will emerge as large numbers of flawed and limited minds battle it out. This concludes part 1 of this book, which was about the first principle of moral psychology: intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. To explain this principle, I used the metaphor of the mind as a rider, reasoning, on an elephant, intuition. And I said that the rider's function is to serve the elephant. Reasoning matters, particularly because reasons do sometimes influence other people. But most of the action in moral psychology is in the intuitions. In part 2, I'll get much more specific about what those intuitions are and where they came from. I'll draw a map of moral space, and I'll show why that map is usually more favorable to conservative politicians than to liberals. Part 2. There's more to morality than harm and fairness. Central metaphor: the righteous mind is like a tongue with 6 taste receptors. Chapter 5. Beyond Weird Morality. I got my PhD at McDonald's. Part of it, anyway, given the hours I spent standing outside of a McDonald's restaurant in West Philadelphia trying to recruit working-class adults to talk with me for my dissertation research. When someone agreed, we'd sit down together at the restaurant's outdoor seating area, and I'd ask them what they thought about the family that ate its dog, the woman who used her flag as a rag, and all the rest. I got some odd looks as the interviews progressed, and also plenty of laughter, particularly when I told people about the guy and the chicken. I was expecting that, because I had written the stories to surprise and even shock people. But what I didn't expect was that these working-class subjects would sometimes find my request for justifications so perplexing. Each time someone said that the people in a story had done something wrong, I asked, "Can you tell me why that was wrong?" When I had interviewed college students on the Penn campus a month earlier, this question brought forth their moral justifications quite smoothly. But a few blocks west, this same question often led to long pauses and disbelieving stares. Those pauses and stares seemed to say, "You mean you don't know why it's wrong to do that to a chicken? I have to explain this to you? What planet are you from?" These subjects were right to wonder about me because I really was weird. I came from a strange and different moral world, the University of Pennsylvania. Penn students were the most unusual of all 12 groups in my study. They were unique in their unwavering devotion to the harm principle, which John Stuart Mill had put forth in 1859. Quote, "The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized society against his will is to prevent harm to others." End quote. As one Penn student said, "It's his chicken, he's eating it, nobody's getting hurt." The Penn students were just as likely as people in the other 11 groups to say that it would bother them to witness the taboo violations, but they were the only group that frequently ignored their own feelings of disgust and said that an action that bothered them was nonetheless morally permissible. And they were the only group in which a majority, 73%, were able to tolerate the chicken story. As one Penn student said, "It's perverted, but if it's done in private, it's his right." I and my fellow Penn students were weird in a second way, too. In 2010, the cultural psychologists Joe Henrich, Steve Heine, and Ara Norenzayan published a profoundly important article titled "The Weirdest People in the World." The authors pointed out that nearly all research in psychology is conducted on a very small subset of the human population, people from cultures that are Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic, forming the acronym WEIRD. They then reviewed dozens of studies showing that weird people are statistical outliers. They are the least typical, least representative people you could study if you want to make generalizations about human nature. Even within the West, Americans are more extreme outliers than Europeans. And within the United States, the educated upper middle class, like my Penn sample, is the most unusual of all. Several of the peculiarities of weird culture can be captured in this simple generalization. The weirder you are, the more you see a world full of separate objects rather than relationships. It has long been reported that Westerners have a more independent and autonomous concept of the self than do East Asians. For example, when asked to write 20 statements beginning with the words, "I am," Americans are likely to list their own internal psychological characteristics: happy, outgoing, interested in jazz. Whereas East Asians are more likely to list their roles and relationships: a son, a husband, an employee of Fujitsu. The differences run deep. Even visual perception is affected. In what's known as the framed line task, you are shown a square with a line drawn inside it. You then turn the page and see an empty square that is larger or smaller than the original square. Your task is to draw a line that is the same as the line you saw on the previous page, either in absolute terms, same number of centimeters, ignore the new frame, or in relative terms, same proportion relative to the frame. Westerners, and particularly Americans, excel at the absolute task because they saw the line as an independent object in the first place and stored it separately in memory. East Asians, in contrast, outperform Americans at the relative task because they automatically perceived and remembered the relationship among the parts. Related to this difference in perception is a difference in thinking style. Most people think holistically, seeing the whole context and the relationships among parts. But weird people think more analytically, detaching the focal object from its context, assigning it to a category, and then assuming that what's true about the category is true about the object. Putting this all together, it makes sense that weird philosophers, since Kant and Mill, have mostly generated moral systems that are individualistic, rule-based, and universalist. That's the morality you need to govern a society of autonomous individuals. But when holistic thinkers in a non-weird culture write about morality, we get something more like the Analects of Confucius, a collection of aphorisms and anecdotes that can't be reduced to a single rule. Confucius talks about a variety of relationship-specific duties and virtues, such as filial piety and the proper treatment of one's subordinates. If weird and non-weird people think differently and see the world differently, then it stands to reason that they'd have different moral concerns. If you see a world full of individuals, then you'll want the morality of Kohlberg and Turiel, a morality that protects those individuals and their individual rights. You'll emphasize concerns about harm and fairness. But if you live in a non-weird society, in which people are more likely to see relationships, contexts, groups, and institutions, then you won't be so focused on protecting individuals. You'll have a more sociocentric morality, which means, as Schwader described it back in Chapter 1, that you place the needs of groups and institutions first, often ahead of the needs of individuals. If you do that, then a morality based on concerns about harm and fairness won't be sufficient. You'll have additional concerns, and you'll need additional virtues to bind people together. Part 2 of this book is about those additional concerns and virtues. It's about the second principle of moral psychology. There is more to morality than harm and fairness. I'm going to try to convince you that this principle is true descriptively, that is, as a portrait of the moralities we see when we look around the world. I'll set aside the question of whether any of these alternative moralities are really good, true, or justifiable. As an intuitionist, I believe it's a mistake to even raise that emotionally powerful question until we've calmed our elephants and cultivated some understanding of what such moralities are trying to accomplish. It's just too easy for our riders to build a case against every morality, political party, and religion that we don't like. So let's try to understand moral diversity first, before we judge other moralities. Three ethics are more descriptive than one. The University of Chicago is proud of its ranking by Playboy magazine as the worst party school in the United States. Winters are long and brutal, bookstores outnumber bars, and students wear T-shirts showing the university crest above phrases such as, "Where fun goes to die," and "Hell does freeze over." I arrived at the university on a September evening in 1992, unpacked my rental truck, and went out for a beer. At the table next to mine, there was a heated argument. A bearded man slammed his hands on the table and shouted, "Damn it, I'm talking about Marx!" This was Richard Schwader's culture. I had been granted a fellowship to work with Schwader for 2 years after I finished my PhD at Penn. Schwader was the leading thinker in cultural psychology, a new discipline that combined the anthropologist's love of context and variability with the psychologist's interest in mental processes. A dictum of cultural psychology is that culture and psyche make each other up. In other words, you can't study the mind while ignoring culture, as psychologists usually do, because minds function only once they've been filled out by a particular culture. And you can't study culture while ignoring psychology, as anthropologists usually do, because social practices and institutions, such as initiation rites, witchcraft, and religion, are to some extent shaped by concepts and desires rooted deep within the human mind, which explains why they often take similar forms on different continents. I was particularly drawn to a new theory of morality Schwader had developed based on his research in ERISA, which I described in Chapter 1. After he published that study, he and his colleagues continued to analyze the 600 interview transcripts they had collected. They found three major clusters of moral themes, which they called the ethics of autonomy, community, and divinity. Each one is based on a different idea about what a person really is. The ethic of autonomy is based on the idea that people are, first and foremost, autonomous individuals with wants, needs, and preferences. People should be free to satisfy those wants, needs, and preferences as they see fit, and so societies develop moral concepts such as rights, liberty, and justice, which allow people to coexist peacefully without interfering too much in each other's projects. This is the dominant ethic in individualistic societies. You find it in the writings of utilitarians, such as John Stuart Mill and Peter Singer, who value justice and rights only to the extent that they increase human welfare. And you find it in the writings of deontologists, such as Kant and Kohlberg, who prize justice and rights even in cases where doing so may reduce overall welfare. But as soon as you step outside of Western secular society, you hear people talking in two additional moral languages. The ethic of community is based on the idea that people are, first and foremost, members of larger entities such as families, teams, armies, companies, tribes, and nations. These larger entities are more than the sum of the people who compose them. They are real, they matter, and they must be protected. People have an obligation to play their assigned roles in these entities. Many societies therefore develop moral concepts such as duty, hierarchy, respect, reputation, and patriotism. In such societies, the Western insistence that people should design their own lives and pursue their own goals seems selfish and dangerous, a sure way to weaken the social fabric and destroy the institutions and collective entities upon which everyone depends. The ethic of divinity is based on the idea that people are, first and foremost, temporary vessels within which a divine soul has been implanted. People are not just animals with an extra serving of consciousness. They are children of God and should behave accordingly. The body is a temple, not a playground. Even if it does no harm and violates nobody's rights when a man has sex with a chicken carcass, he still shouldn't do it, because it degrades him, dishonors his creator, and violates the sacred order of the universe. Many societies therefore develop moral concepts such as sanctity and sin, purity and pollution, elevation and degradation. In such societies, the personal liberty of secular Western nations looks like libertinism, hedonism, and a celebration of humanity's baser instincts. I first read about Schwader's three ethics in 1991, after I had collected my data in Brazil, but before I had written my dissertation. I realized that all of my best stories, the ones that got people to react emotionally without being able to find a victim, involved either disrespect, which violated the ethics of community, for example, using a flag as a rag, or disgust and carnality, which violated the ethics of divinity, for example, the thing with the chicken. I used Schwader's theory to analyze the justifications people gave when I asked them, "Can you tell me why?" And it worked like magic. The Penn students spoke almost exclusively in the language of the ethic of autonomy, whereas the other groups, particularly the working class groups, made much more use of the ethic of community and a little bit more use of the ethic of divinity. Soon after I arrived in Chicago, I applied for a Fulbright Fellowship to spend 3 months in India, where I hoped to get a closer look at the ethic of divinity. It had been the rarest of the three ethics in my dissertation data. Because I was able to draw on Schwader's extensive network of friends and colleagues in Bhubaneswar, the capital city of Orissa, it was easy for me to put together a detailed research proposal, which was funded. After spending a year in Chicago, reading cultural psychology and learning from Schwader and his students, I flew off to India in September 1993. How I became a pluralist. I was extraordinarily well-hosted and well-treated. I was given the use of a lovely apartment, which came with its own full-time cook and servant. For $5 a day, I rented a car and driver. I was welcomed at the local university by Professor Biranshi Puhan, an old friend of Schwader's, who gave me an office and introduced me to the rest of the psychology department, from which I recruited a research team of eager students. Within a week, I was ready to begin my work, which was supposed to be a series of experiments on moral judgment, particularly violations of the ethics of divinity. But these experiments taught me little in comparison to what I learned just from stumbling around the complex social web of a small Indian city and then talking with my hosts and advisors about my confusion. One cause of confusion was that I had brought with me two incompatible identities. On one hand, I was a 29-year-old liberal atheist with very definite views about right and wrong. On the other hand, I wanted to be like those open-minded anthropologists I had read so much about and had studied with, such as Alan Fisk and Richard Schwader. My first few weeks in Bhubaneswar were therefore filled with feelings of shock and dissonance. I dined with men whose wives silently served us and then retreated to the kitchen, not speaking to me the entire evening. I was told to be stricter with my servants and to stop thanking them for serving me. I watched people bathe in and cook with visibly polluted water that was held to be sacred. In short, I was immersed in a sex-segregated, hierarchically stratified, devoutly religious society, and I was committed to understanding it on its own terms, not on mine. It only took a few weeks for my dissonance to disappear, not because I was a natural anthropologist, but because the normal human capacity for empathy kicked in. I liked these people who were hosting me, helping me, and teaching me. Wherever I went, people were kind to me. And when you're grateful to people, it's easier to adopt their perspective. My elephant leaned toward them, which made my rider search for moral arguments in their defense. Rather than automatically rejecting the men as sexist oppressors and pitying the women, children, and servants as helpless victims, I began to see a moral world in which families, not individuals, are the basic unit of society, and the members of each extended family, including its servants, are intensely interdependent. In this world, equality and personal autonomy were not sacred values. Honoring elders, gods, and guests, protecting subordinates, and fulfilling one's role-based duties were more important. I had read about Schwader's ethic of community and had understood it intellectually. But now, for the first time in my life, I began to feel it. I could see beauty in a moral code that emphasizes duty, respect for one's elders, service to the group, and negation of the self's desires. I could still see its ugly side. I could see that power sometimes leads to pomposity and abuse. And I could see that the subordinates, particularly women, were often blocked from doing what they wanted to do by the whims of their elders, male and female. But for the first time in my life, I was able to step outside of my home morality, the ethic of autonomy. I had a place to stand, and from the vantage point of the ethic of community, the ethic of autonomy now seemed overly individualistic and self-focused. In my 3 months in India, I met very few Americans. But when I boarded the plane to fly back to Chicago, I heard a loud voice with an unmistakably American accent saying, "Look, you tell him that this is the compartment over my seat, and I have a right to use it." I cringed. The same thing happened with the ethic of divinity. I understood intellectually what it meant to treat the body as a temple rather than as a playground, but that was an analytical concept I used to make sense of people who were radically different from me. I personally was quite fond of pleasure, and I could see little reason to choose less of it rather than more. And I was quite devoted to efficiency, so I could see little reason to spend an hour or two each day saying prayers and performing rituals. But there I was in Bhubaneswar, interviewing Hindu priests, monks, and lay people about their concepts of purity and pollution, and trying to understand why Hindus place so much emphasis on bathing, food choices, and concerns about what or whom a person has touched. Why do Hindu gods care about the state of their devotees' bodies? And it's not just Hindu gods. The Quran and the Hebrew Bible reveal similar concerns, and many Christians believe that cleanliness is next to godliness. In graduate school, I had done some research on moral disgust, and that prepared me to think about these questions. I had teamed up with Paul Rozin, one of the leading experts on the psychology of food and eating, and Clark McCauley, a social psychologist at nearby Bryn Mawr College. We wanted to know why the emotion of disgust, which clearly originated as an emotion that keeps us away from dirty and contaminating things, can now be triggered by some moral violations, such as betrayal or child abuse, but not by others, such as robbing a bank or cheating on one's taxes. Our theory, in brief, was that the human mind automatically perceives a kind of vertical dimension of social space, running from God, or moral perfection at the top, down through angels, humans, other animals, monsters, demons, and then the devil, or perfect evil, at the bottom. The list of supernatural beings varies from culture to culture, and you don't find this vertical dimension elaborated in every culture, but you do find the idea that high equals good equals pure equals God, whereas low equals bad equals dirty equals animal quite widely. So widely, in fact, that it seems to be a kind of archetype, if you like Jungian terminology, or innately prepared idea, if you prefer the language of evolutionary psychology. Our idea was that moral disgust is felt whenever we see or hear about people whose behavior shows them to be low on this vertical dimension. People feel degraded when they think about such things, just as they feel elevated by hearing about virtuous actions. A man who robs a bank does a bad thing, and we want to see him punished. But a man who betrays his own parents or who enslaves children for the sex trade seems monstrous, lacking in some basic human sentiment. Such actions revolt us and seem to trigger some of the same physiology of disgust as would seeing rats scampering out of a trash can. That was our theory, and it was rather easy to find evidence for it in India. Hindu notions of reincarnation could not be more explicit. Our souls reincarnate into higher or lower creatures in the next life based on the virtue of our conduct during this life. But as with the ethic of community, the big surprise for me was that after a few months, I began to feel the ethic of divinity in subtle ways. Some of these feelings were related to the physical facts of dirt and cleanliness in Bhubaneswar. Cows and dogs roamed freely around town, so you had to step carefully around their droppings. You sometimes saw people defecating by the roadside, and garbage was often heaped into fly-swarmed piles. It therefore began to feel natural to me to adopt the Indian practice of removing my shoes when I entered any private home, creating a sharp boundary between dirty and clean spaces. As I visited temples, I became attuned to their spiritual topography. The courtyard is higher, more pure, than the street. The antechamber of the temple higher still. And the inner sanctum, where the god was housed, could be entered only by the Brahmin priest, who had followed all the necessary rules of personal purity. Private homes had a similar topography, and I had to be sure never to enter the kitchen or the room where offerings were made to deities. The topography of purity even applies to your own body. You eat with your right hand after washing it, and you use your left hand to clean yourself with water after defecation. So you develop an intuitive sense that left equals dirty and right equals clean. It becomes second nature that you don't give things to others using your left hand. If these new feelings were just a new ability to detect invisible dirt rays emanating from objects, they would have helped me to understand obsessive-compulsive disorder, but not morality. These feelings were more than that. In the ethic of divinity, there is an order to the universe, and things, as well as people, should be treated with the reverence or disgust that they deserve. When I returned to Chicago, I began to feel positive essences emanating from some objects. It felt right to me to treat certain books with reverence, not leaving them on the floor or taking them into the bathroom. Funeral services and even burial, which had previously seemed to me to be such a waste of money and space, began to make more emotional sense. The human body does not suddenly become an object, like that of any other animal corpse, at the moment of death. There are right ways and wrong ways of treating bodies, even when there is no conscious being inside the body to experience mistreatment. I also began to understand why the American culture wars involved so many battles over sacrilege. Is the flag just a piece of cloth, which can be burned as a form of protest? Or does each flag contain within it something non-material, such that when protesters burn it, they have done something bad, even if nobody were to see them do it? When an artist submerges a crucifix in a jar of his own urine, or smears elephant dung on an image of the Virgin Mary, do these works belong in art museums? Can the artist simply tell religious Christians, if you don't want to see it, don't go to the museum? Or does the mere existence of such works make the world dirtier, more profane, and more degraded? If you can't see anything wrong here, try reversing the politics. Imagine that a conservative artist had created these works using images of Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela instead of Jesus and Mary. Imagine that his intent was to mock the quasi-deification by the left of so many black leaders. Could such works be displayed in museums in New York or Paris without triggering angry demonstrations? Might some on the left feel that the museum itself had been polluted by racism even after the paintings were removed? As with the ethic of community, I had read about the ethic of divinity before going to India, and had understood it intellectually. But in India, and in the years after I returned, I felt it. I could see beauty in a moral code that emphasized self-control, resistance to temptation, cultivation of one's higher, nobler self, and negation of the self's desires. I could see the dark side of this ethic, too. Once you allow visceral feelings of disgust to guide your conception of what God wants, then minorities who trigger even a hint of disgust in the majority, such as homosexuals or obese people, can be ostracized and treated cruelly. The ethic of divinity is sometimes incompatible with compassion, egalitarianism, and basic human rights. But at the same time, it offers a valuable perspective from which we can understand and critique some of the ugly parts of secular societies. For example, why are many of us bothered by rampant materialism? If some people want to work hard in order to earn money, in order to buy luxury goods, in order to impress others, how can we criticize them using the ethic of autonomy? To offer another example, I was recently eating lunch at a UVA dining hall. At the table next to me, two young women were talking. One of them was very grateful for something the other had agreed to do for her. To express her gratitude, she exclaimed, "Oh my God, if you were a guy, I'd be so on your dick right now." I felt a mixture of amusement and revulsion, but how could I criticize her from within the ethic of autonomy? The ethic of divinity lets us give voice to inchoate feelings of elevation and degradation, our sense of higher and lower. It gives us a way to condemn crass consumerism and mindless or trivialized sexuality. We can understand long-standing laments about the spiritual emptiness of a consumer society in which everyone's mission is to satisfy their personal desires. Stepping out of the matrix. Among the most profound ideas that have arisen around the world and across eras is that the world we experience is an illusion, akin to a dream. Enlightenment is a form of waking up. You find this idea in many religions and philosophies, and it's also a staple of science fiction, particularly since William Gibson's 1984 novel, Neuromancer. Gibson coined the term cyberspace and described it as a matrix that emerges when a billion computers are connected and people get enmeshed in a consensual hallucination. The creators of the movie The Matrix developed Gibson's idea into a gorgeous and frightening visual experience. In one of its most famous scenes, the protagonist, Neo, is given a choice. He can take a red pill, which will disconnect him from the Matrix, dissolve the hallucination, and give him command of his actual physical body, which is lying in a vat of goo. Or he can take a blue pill, forget he was ever given this choice, and his consciousness will return to the rather pleasant hallucination in which nearly all human beings spend their conscious existence. Neo swallows the red pill, and the Matrix dissolves around him. It wasn't quite as dramatic for me, but Schwader's writings were my red pill. I began to see that many moral matrices coexist within each nation. Each matrix provides a complete, unified, and emotionally compelling worldview, easily justified by observable evidence and nearly impregnable to attack by arguments from outsiders. I grew up Jewish in the suburbs of New York City. My grandparents had fled Tsarist Russia and found work in New York's garment industry. For their generation, socialism and labor unions were effective responses to the exploitation and terrible working conditions they faced. Franklin Roosevelt was the heroic leader who protected workers and defeated Hitler. Jews ever since have been among the most reliable voters for the Democratic Party. My morality wasn't just shaped by my family and ethnicity. I attended Yale University, which was ranked at the time as the second most liberal of the Ivy League schools. It was not uncommon during class discussions for teachers and students to make jokes and critical comments about Ronald Reagan, the Republican Party, or the conservative position on controversial current events. Being liberal was cool. Being liberal was righteous. Yale students in the 1980s strongly supported the victims of apartheid, the people of El Salvador, the government of Nicaragua, the environment, and Yale's own striking labor unions, which deprived us all of dining halls for much of my senior year. Liberalism seemed so obviously ethical. Liberals marched for peace, workers' rights, civil rights, and secularism. The Republican Party was, as we saw it, the party of war, big business, racism, and evangelical Christianity. I could not understand how any thinking person would voluntarily embrace the party of evil, and so I and my fellow liberals looked for psychological explanations of conservatism, but not liberalism. We supported liberal policies because we saw the world clearly and wanted to help people, but they supported conservative policies out of pure self-interest, lower my taxes, or thinly veiled racism, stop funding welfare programs for minorities. We never considered the possibility that there were alternative moral worlds in which reducing harm by helping victims and increasing fairness by pursuing group-based equality were not the main goals. And if we could not imagine other moralities, then we could not believe that conservatives were as sincere in their moral beliefs as we were in ours. When I moved from Yale to Penn, and then from Penn to the University of Chicago, the matrix stayed pretty much the same. It was only in India that I had to stand alone. Had I been there as a tourist, it would have been easy to maintain my matrix membership for 3 months. I'd have met up now and then with other Western tourists, and we would have swapped stories about the sexism, poverty, and oppression we had seen. But because I was there to study cultural psychology, I did everything I could to fit into another matrix, one woven mostly from the ethics of community and divinity. When I returned to America, social conservatives no longer seemed so crazy. I could listen to leaders of the religious right, such as Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, with a kind of clinical detachment. They want more prayer and spanking in schools and less sex education and access to abortion? I didn't think those steps would reduce AIDS and teen pregnancy, but I could see why Christian conservatives wanted to thicken up the moral climate of schools and discourage the view that children should be as free as possible to act on their desires. Social conservatives think that welfare programs and feminism increase rates of single motherhood and weaken the traditional social structures that compel men to support their own children? Well, now that I was no longer on the defensive, I could see that those arguments made sense, even if there are also many good effects of liberating women from dependence on men. I had escaped from my prior partisan mindset, reject first, ask rhetorical questions later, and began to think about liberal and conservative policies as manifestations of deeply conflicting but equally heartfelt visions of the good society. It felt good to be released from partisan anger. And once I was no longer angry, I was no longer committed to reaching the conclusion that righteous anger demands, we are right, they are wrong. I was able to explore new moral matrices, each one supported by its own intellectual traditions. It felt like a kind of awakening. In 1991, Schwader wrote about the power of cultural psychology to cause such awakenings. Quote, "Yet the conceptions held by others are available to us, in the sense that when we truly understand their conception of things, we come to recognize possibilities latent within our own rationality, and those ways of conceiving of things become salient for us for the first time or once again. In other words, there is no homogeneous backcloth to our world. We are multiple from the start." End quote. I cannot overstate the importance of this quotation for moral and political psychology. We are multiple from the start. Our minds have the potential to become righteous about many different concerns, and only a few of these concerns are activated during childhood. Other potential concerns are left undeveloped and unconnected to the web of shared meanings and values that become our adult moral matrix. If you grow up in a weird society, you become so well educated in the ethic of autonomy that you can detect oppression and inequality even where the apparent victims see nothing wrong. But years later, when you travel or become a parent, or perhaps just read a good novel about a traditional society, you might find some other moral intuitions latent within yourself. You might find yourself responding to dilemmas involving authority, sexuality, or the human body in ways that are hard to explain. Conversely, if you are raised in a more traditional society or within an evangelical Christian household in the United States, you become so well educated in the ethics of community and divinity that you can detect disrespect and degradation even where the apparent victims see nothing wrong. But if you then face discrimination yourself, as conservatives and Christians sometimes do in the academic world, or if you simply listen to Martin Luther King Jr.'s "I Have a Dream" speech, you may find a new resonance in moral arguments about oppression and equality. In sum, the second principle of moral psychology is there's more to morality than harm and fairness. In support of this claim, I described research showing that people who grow up in Western, educated, industrial, rich, and democratic, or weird, societies, are statistical outliers on many psychological measures, including measures of moral psychology. I also showed that, 1, the weirder you are, the more you perceive a world full of separate objects rather than relationships. 2, moral pluralism is true descriptively. As a simple matter of anthropological fact, the moral domain varies across cultures. 3, the moral domain is unusually narrow in weird cultures, where it is largely limited to the ethic of autonomy, that is, moral concerns about individuals harming, oppressing, or cheating other individuals. It is broader, including the ethics of community and divinity, in most other societies, and within religious and conservative moral matrices within weird societies. 4. Moral matrices bind people together and blind them to the coherence or even existence of other matrices. This makes it very difficult for people to consider the possibility that there might really be more than one form of moral truth, or more than one valid framework for judging people or running a society. In the next 3 chapters, I'll catalog the moral intuitions, showing exactly what else there is beyond harm and fairness. I'll show how a small set of innate and universal moral foundations can be used to construct a great variety of moral matrices. I'll offer tools you can use to understand moral arguments emanating from matrices that are not your own. Chapter 6, Taste Buds of the Righteous Mind. A few years ago, I tried a restaurant called The True Taste. The interior was entirely white. Each table was set only with spoons, 5 small spoons at each place setting. I sat down at a table and looked at the menu. It was divided into sections labeled sugars, honeys, tree saps, and artificials. I called the waiter over and asked him to explain. Did they not serve food? The waiter, it turned out, was also the owner and sole employee of the restaurant. He told me that the restaurant was the first of its kind in the world. It was a tasting bar for sweeteners. I could sample sweeteners from 32 countries. He explained that he was a biologist who specialized in the sense of taste. He described to me the 5 kinds of taste receptor found in each taste bud on the tongue: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and savory, also called umami. He said that in his research, he had discovered that activation of the sweet receptor produced the strongest surge of dopamine in the brain, which indicated to him that humans are hardwired to seek sweetness above the other 4 tastes. He therefore reasoned that it was most efficient, in terms of units of pleasure per calorie, to consume sweeteners, and he conceived the idea of opening a restaurant aimed entirely at stimulating this one taste receptor. I asked him how business was going. "Terrible," he said, "but at least I'm doing better than the chemist down the street who opened a salt tasting bar." Okay, this didn't really happen to me, but it's a metaphor for how I feel sometimes when I read books about moral philosophy and psychology. Morality is so rich and complex, so multifaceted and internally contradictory. Pluralists, such as Schwader, rise to the challenge, offering theories that can explain moral diversity within and across cultures. Yet many authors reduce morality to a single principle, usually some variant of welfare maximization, basically, help people, don't hurt them. Or sometimes it's justice and related notions of fairness, rights, or respect for individuals and their autonomy. There's the utilitarian grill, serving only sweeteners, that is, welfare, and the deontological diner, serving only salts, that is, rights. Those are your options. Neither Schwader nor I am saying that anything goes, or that all societies and all cuisines are equally good, but we believe that moral monism, the attempt to ground all of morality on a single principle, leads to societies that are unsatisfying to most people and at high risk of becoming inhumane because they ignore so many other moral principles. We humans all have the same 5 taste receptors, but we don't all like the same foods. To understand where these differences come from, we can start with an evolutionary story about sugary fruits and fatty animals, which were good for our common ancestors. But we'll also have to examine the history of each culture, and we'll have to look at the